equipped, wasn't adequately equipped for this, for the kind of research you were doing?
Okay. When I came back here in 1946, we had a good amount of money from the state legislature for the Brucella work. And it was well-funded, because this was a problem, of course, dear to the hearts of the legislature, so having to do with a disease of dairy cattle. I should, of course, emphasize that while I was the one in bacteriology who was given the problem of working with Brucella, there were a number of people in veterinary science. So I wasn't working in a wilderness here.
Yeah.
Dave Berman.
The cat brain man.
Huh?
The cat brain man.
No.
Another one.
The cat.
That's Al Berman.
That's Al Berman.
You're right.
This is David Berman,
mm-hmm.
in veterinary science.
He
was a long time associate dean of the graduate school. So I don't know what. But David Berman was a graduate veterinarian from Cornell who took a PhD here, and he and I collaborated in a lot of Brucella work, a lot of staphylococcal work
uh-huh.
over the years. So, and other people down there.
Yeah. But you did have, so you could get equipment that you needed.
We had no problem with equipment, but you've got to keep in mind that equipment wasn't available.
Oh.
In the late 1940s, while we may have had money to buy some things, there wasn't a whole lot of equipment to buy.
Was this because formerly it had mostly been made in Europe and equipment of this sort?
No, I don't think so. Is the fact that the microbiologists were not, World War II was one reason.
Yes, of course.
And when I came back here, we simply couldn't buy pH meters, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But Marv Johnson had a pH meter that he built in his laboratory.
He was a genius at that. Mm-hmm.
And so he provided pH meters for a lot of us out of his laboratory. If we would buy the parts, he would put it together for us.
Will anybody listen to this know what a pH meter is? I don't.
Well, all right. It's an electronic laboratory instrument for measuring the acidity of a solution.
I see.
How acid or how
yeah.
basic it is. Who determines the pH of the...
I see. It's
which
what
is
one
the,
does with one's land, with one's garden.
Yes,
that's it, yes.
exactly, yeah.
yeah.
And so... But in the late 1940s, bacteriologists really didn't have much complicated equipment in their laboratory.
You hadn't gone into the mass spectrometers. And
mass spectrometers were available only as research instruments prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
No, we had not, and neither had anybody else, as a matter of fact, at that time. That's 35 years ago we're talking
about. I thought they were getting them in the late 40s. I mean,
but only as research tools. Now, let me put it this way. In the late 1930s, Bob Burris went to Columbia University as on a postdoc to work with Urey. Now, maybe Bob has told you all this.
Well, he talked about that, yes.
And to find out how to use heavy nitrogen,
mm-hmm.
and which you had to use a mass spectrometer for analysis. When he came back here, then there was a mass spectrometer over in physics.
Mm.
But the physicists considered it as a research instrument. They were interested not in using a mass spectrometer, they were interested in development of it. So Bob would get some samples and just have to hold them for months because the mass spectrometer had been taken apart so they could make one little change and see what that did to the instrument. They were developing it, is what they were doing. And this was true in other parts of the country, too. So the idea of going out and buying a mass spectrometer from an instrument company, really, Bob could tell you better than I, but I suspect it was in the late 1950s or maybe middle 1950s before you could do that.
I see.
What you could buy starting in the late 1950s were instruments to measure radioactivity.
Do you mean late 1940s?
I'm sorry, the late 1940s. Mm. You could, rather relative, what we would call relatively crude now, but you could buy them.
Mm-hmm. Were you needing those?
We were needing those because we were working with the radioactive carbon. For our carbon dioxide work with Brucella. Hmm. But we had money to buy things like that. So we certainly, in our Brucella work, there was money available. And we didn't have any problem there.
At some point, you one of the articles is about the use of the electron microscope.
Oh, yes.
Was that something new? Yes,
it was. There was one electron microscope on the campus in the early 1950s. This was in the basement of the Soils Building. It was bought by the College of Agriculture and was jointly used by everybody. Paul Kaysberg, who's now in biochemistry, was hired as a fresh PhD physicist to run the electron microscope for the university.
Huh. People would bring things to him and he would...
That's right. People would bring things to him, people would, and under his direction, would learn how to prepare them and take them over there. And so the first electron microscopy we did was, and I'd have to go back and look at the dates, but must have been in the early 1950s, was when Paul was, when the electron microscope, and then Paul moved that microscope to the biochemistry department, and they bought another electron, they had two of them, and I guess by that time in the middle to late 50s there were others being used around the campus, but Not a great number. I guess Hans Ries had one over in zoology, but
did each department eventually get one?
Each department eventually got one. Each department eventually got what they call an electron microscope laboratory with one or more. Bacteriology ended up with an electron microscope laboratory with two electron microscopes in it. Here in the medical school, anatomy has several, finally now, and so on. But interestingly enough, they are not used as heavily now as they were once, and so.
You mean everywhere, or?
Everywhere. We eventually put in a scanning electron microscope here in the medical school, and that's something that I had something to do with in about 1977 or 78. And this was about fourth one on the campus of a scanning EM, but there's one in plant pathology, one in engineering, and two, I guess, in here, one in the hospital. But they're not used very much anymore now, either.
Something else has replaced them.
They just don't do that kind of work as much as they did, and all. I guess that, and also the transmission electron microscopes are not used nearly as much as they were.
Were they expensive investments
at that time? We wouldn't call that we wouldn't call them expensive now, but they certainly were in the dollars that we used to buy them then. Yes.
One of the speculations that's been made is that if one's invested in a very expensive piece of equipment, I mean, a really very expensive, why one has to gear one's research to it, even though perhaps it is no longer the right direction to go in.
This is right, and this is a very difficult proposition for somebody who wants to go out. The man that was hired in bacteriology to run the the electron microscope laboratory, Jack Pate, I'm told now, while he still runs the electron microscope, he was brought here from the University of Washington, as a matter of fact, to do this. And he used in his research at that time, used the EM very much, did a lot of work with it. Now I'm told he hardly ever touches the electron microscope anymore. His research had gone off in another direction. And the young woman who's the assistant chairman over bacteriology tells me that they're having a hard time financing that electron microscope laboratory because it had been financed with revolving funds. That is, people who used it paid for the use out of their, used the scopes paid on a time basis out of their research funds. But nobody uses it much anymore, so they have a hard time keeping up that laboratory.
But they still need it.
Still need it. Still need it. Still need it. But they've got to find some other way of funding it rather than on a revolving fund.
Is it, this may be so familiar, something that's been discussed, in which case don't answer it, but is it at all, it must be a problem when some new piece of equipment comes on like that to learn how to use it. I mean, you said you started using.
Oh, yes, it is. And there are. It is difficult to learn how to use it.
I mean, for you even to know how to think how to do your work so that you, is that right, so that you would use it, or?
Well, yes, except that you read the literature and you read about something where somebody who used an electron microscope, say, to show the interior of yeast cells.
Yeah, and you say,
and
oh,
you think, ah, I yeah. need that.
So that's just, in effect, a better microscope.
In effect, it is a better microscope, that's right.
And but there must be some, I don't know, whether radioactive isotopes.
The radioactive isotopes, sure. You've got to learn new techniques.
Mm.
And this is the problem with old scientists and faculty members. There's sometimes your students who've just gone down and taken a course in isotopes. Techniques and biochemistry end up by knowing a lot more about it than you do.
Well, then at least somebody in the lab does know.
Somebody in the lab does know, yes. Mm. But and generally, too, these kinds of techniques are taken care of by courses being taught and people seeing a need for courses.
Mm-hmm.
They teach some courses in, I guess they still teach them in biochemistry, where you can take various segments of a course, build up from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 credits. It's a techniques course. And if you want a want to learn isotope techniques, you can take the segment, the 1 credit segment of their technique course, and this kind of thing. Yes. But yes, that's the problem.
Yeah. I interviewed Jim Crow recently, and he talked about the effect of having Lederberg here on campus, and you mentioned being influenced or one of your students.
Oh, sure, yes,
by him.
We were.
To what extent did you come in contact with him, or did you take his course?
I sat in on his course. I sat in on some of his lectures.
Mm-hmm.
He gave a seminar, and I sat in on some of the seminar topics that were given. Yes, of course. Anybody like that. Influences the kind of work that goes on, particularly in what I would call a very hot area at the time he was doing it. There was a steady stream of people to the campus to either give seminars or to work in his laboratory, and we would get them to give lectures and so on, so that provided a lot of stimulation. But that's true, and I'm not saying that Josh certainly did this, he brought a lot, but that's true with other people too. When Harlan Halverson was here, mm-hmm. he brought a lot of people to the campus. Who were interested in what he was doing, and he would meet them at meetings, and they would come here to give seminars and so on. And that's true with anybody who's active in research.
Well, you mentioned the two examples that I would know as having been outstanding people here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are there others that you would think of? That
Jim Crow is one of them, of course, too.
Oh, is he?
There were always people coming around and visiting with Jim, and let me think. The people, Mike Foster, and the people over in the Food Research Institute. There's always people through here to find out what's going on at the Food Research Institute, and many of them give lectures.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know anything about that.
Well, this is in food safety and food toxicology. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. I'd have to. We've given those two as examples there. They're very good examples. Right off the top of my head, I think
there wouldn't be a great many people who would be focuses of this sort.
No, they're not. They're always there's always somebody around who's a focus on that. Yeah, sure. The people in molecular biology that are here now. Now, I'll admit that I haven't been on the campus much in the last 3 or 4 years, but we just had Bob Round was here. I can't think of names now, but anyway, there was always somebody giving a lecture in molecular biology around here. So Van Potter, Henry Pito, the Millers, the group over there in oncology. There are always lectures going on.
Because they're here,
yes. Uh-huh. And they attract other people here, and then they go to meetings, and they invite other people back here, you know. And,
so that's an important part of the
community. It's
very
important. Kenneth Rapel over in bacteriology. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you have.
He's somebody that I gather I should interview. He's been mentioned.
He's one of the eminent mycologists of the country. He's mm-hmm. retired now. He isolated the strain of penicillium that is used to produce penicillin. And there were always young people coming to his laboratory. Yeah.
Was he mentioned, there's a book out on the research, the discovery of penicillin. Is his work, taken up in that?
I don't know that book at all.
About that.
I don't know whether you, back in late 1940s, maybe. Life magazine had an article on penicillin. They had a picture of a young woman on the front page who was picking up a cantaloupe, and it showed a penicillium growing on that cantaloupe. Uh-huh. The person could recognize it as a penicillium. Anyway, that was Ken's technician buying a cantaloupe, and he worked at Peoria at the USDA lab at the time. And they gave Ken that picture, and for a long gave Ken that painting, and for a long time he had that over in his over in the bacteriology building. I don't know what's happened to that picture, but it's the Moldy Mary, they call it.
When in biochemistry, they made a big point of sending graduate students over to Europe for a year before they took up teaching here. Evidently, I suppose, because of the work being done in Europe, and that was not true, is that right, of bacteriology?
No,
it wasn't true of genetics.
No, that's not true. It's not true that it wasn't done. There was a lot of work going on, particularly in England.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, Elizabeth McCoy went to Czechoslovakia after she finished her PhD. Perry Wilson worked at Cambridge, and that's where he became interested in working on bacterial respiration, things that both Bob and I did when we were graduate students in Perry's lab. But then, let's see, Mar Johnson, of course, worked, well, he was in biochemistry, but he worked
in
Prague, too.
Well, that's the 30s, people. Well, obviously, you couldn't do it in the 40s.
You couldn't do it in the 40s, until the late 1940s, but...
By that time, it had all switched to the United States anyway.
No, there was still a lot of work going on, and but the kind of funding was different. It was Fulbright funding, and National Institutes of Health funding for it, but a lot of our students did go to some of these laboratories. Some of them stayed in this country, but some of them went to European laboratories too. Now I'd have to stop and think. We got a lot of students from European laboratories coming to this country too for postdoctoral work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ken Raper had a number of them in his laboratory, for example. I had a young man from Japan. I had a man from France. I had a man from England. So we had people coming to this country too.
Yes, what I was referring to, I think, really was something that
but
was
most
pretty much up away from.
Well, I wouldn't say so.
I gather you had to go in the 30s.
Oh,
you couldn't get
all right.
It here.
Putting it that way,
yeah,
you had to go. Yes, you had
to
go. But people who were in bacteriology, Dick Hansen, PhD from Illinois, spent 2 years in France before he came here. Glenn Chambliss, who's over there now, spent 2 years in France. He took his PhD at Chicago, but spent 2 years in France before he came directly here. Bill McLean, who's over in bacteriology now, spent 2 years at the Molecular Biology Institute at Cambridge before he came here, and so on.
Mm.
So it's,
it's there is a lot.
There is a lot, mm-hmm. Yeah. But, yeah.
Well, what about the developments in genetics? How important were they? I mean, you spoke of one discovery that had to do with genetics. And I noticed you're using words in your article such as recombinant and...
Yeah.
That's all from genetics, isn't it?
All from genetics, yes. Yes, well, genetics is a part of microbiology. It's a part of bacteriology. And I don't know really what the thrust of your question is, but...
Probably doesn't have much. I don't know enough about it, but I wondered whether, for instance, just the discovery of DNA and whether they had any influence on your thinking.
Oh, of course. Yes, it did. And the fact that the DNA that was worked with and the discovery of DNA did come from bacteria, came from E. coli. the much of the early work on DNA and gene mapping was done in bacteria. Much of the early work of what we would call molecular biology of DNA and of genetics came from one organism, Escherichia coli, a bacteria, a little gram-negative bacterium. But
sounds like you felt rather possessive about the whole field.
Well, I don't mean to. All I'm saying is, you know, it's been asked before, why didn't we develop in bacteriology, why wasn't bacterial genetics exploited here at Wisconsin in bacteriology? Why was it done in genetics? Mm-hmm. And I guess I would answer that simply by saying that the geneticists were the first to, I guess, recognize the importance of this. And then when they brought Josh here, I can remember conferences in Dr. Fraser's laboratory with Alexander Brink and Dr. Irwin, Bob Irwin, mm-hmm. about the kind of person they should bring here. And there was a young man, well, they were considering two, I can remember when they talked to us. One was Max Zelle, who was at Cornell, who had been trained in, well, who you see, and I don't mean to sound, but microbial genetics didn't start with Tatum and Lederberg in that group. No. There were people who were talking about microbial genetics long before, and Max Zelle was a young man who got a PhD at Cornell and had worked with some people at Cornell who felt that they were doing work in bacterial genetics too. And so it was a question with Dr. Brink and Dr. Irwin, which of these people should they bring here? Well, of course, Josh had the inside track because he had worked with Ed Tatum, and Ed Tatum's background here, Ed Tatum had been a student of Dr. Peterson's and Dr. Fred's, mm-hmm. And Tatum was pushing Josh for the job here, and so the genetics department hired him. Well, with the relatively limited money for faculty at that time, it didn't seem reasonable that bacteriology should go out and hire another bacterial geneticist just because we didn't have one in the bacteriology department. And really, indeed, it was not until the need developed for a course in bacterial genetics to be taught at the undergraduate level that bacteriology finally hired a microbial genetics, and that's Martha Howe, a microbial geneticist, and that's Martha Howe. Even though people, and she came to the campus about 1973, 1974, something like that. But you see, Millard Sussman came here, and Bob Metzenberg in physiological chemistry as a Neurospora geneticist, a fungal geneticist, and
they sort of squeezed you out of it.
No, I wouldn't look at it like that at all. I look at it this way, that there's a limited amount of money, a limited amount of faculty, and if it's a question of do you want to really hire in duplicate just to have somebody working in your department in this area, or as long as Lederberg was his course in microbial genetics was joint listed with bacteriology, and he actually worked in the bacteriology building for a while. Mm-hmm. We didn't feel the need of hiring anyone.
Well, you know, Bowers was pushing very hard to have bacteriology hire a geneticist.
Medical microbiology here, you mean?
He wanted. He wrote to Sarles.
Yeah, right.
Hoping that they would look for a geneticist.
Yeah. That was when Josh left, I guess. See, Josh left in the late 1950s, didn't he?
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure.
'59.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I'm sure Bill has told you why that we didn't, it wasn't done at that time.
Mm. He said there wasn't money.
That's probably right. There wasn't money to add a new person. And anyway, Millard Sussman had been hired, or was hired in genetics now. I'm not sure when Millard came, but he had a very active program in Neurospora work and in microbial genetics, yeah. Then Schabowski came to McArdle, and Schabowski's early work was in microbial genetics. And matter of fact, we used one of his techniques before, and I met him through Werner Braun, as a matter of fact. At Rutgers, yeah.
Well, the other question.
But
yes,
we hired in bacteriology at that time hired a David Pratt, who was a PhD from Davis. Dave Pratt had gotten his PhD in tomato genetics. But then he went to Copenhagen and worked for a couple of years and became interested there in genetics of bacteriophage, bacterial viruses, and we hired him back here, and I believe Dave came here, it must have been in 61 or 62. So we did hire a geneticist, but we hired a virus geneticist, and Dave actually taught our course in virology, and then Dave and Howard Timmon taught it together. Of course, after Howard came here in McArdle,
mm-hmm.
And Howard was a bacteriophage geneticist when he came here. So anyway, no, I look upon the fact if there are people on the campus who are experts in these areas and. There are graduate students, they offer courses that graduate students can take. And if we in research or know what they're doing and that's available to those ideas and techniques are available to us and they complement our research and we can do it, I don't think it's necessary to hire a bacterial geneticist just to have one in the bacteriology building. Now, a lot of people, when I've gone around the country and we talked about work, and for example, Dave Berman and Vet Science and I, they could never understand how we worked so closely together and published a lot of papers together because we were in different departments. Mm-hmm. They just couldn't understand it. And then we had Dave and I had NIH grants that we did jointly. And then, well, just recently, we had when we put in for the molecular biology training program here, mm-hmm. back in the early 1970s. And we had a number of different departments and faculty from different departments, at the NIH who were reviewing these things just couldn't understand how we could make it work, that we were not in the same departments, not even in the same colleges. There are people in the medical school in letters and science and ag that work together for the molecular biology training program.
Excuse me, is that the same as the molecular biology lab?
No. The molecular biology laboratory was there before the molecular biology training program.
I really know what the lab is. What is the training program?
The molecular biology training program is a, is a, is a, is money from the National Institutes of Health on what they call a training grant. What they call a training grant. And when I was the first director of it, and we administered it with Joe Kelly, who through the biophysics department, in that's housed in molecular biology. But he was, we hired him as our administrator for it.
Is it something like the BioCorp? I mean, is it a?
No, it's not. It's not courses, at all. But it's just a group. There was money for trainees, there was money for equipment, there was money for supplies. These were pre-doctoral graduate students. And even though they may work in biochemistry and be biochemistry majors, may work in zoology and be zoology majors, or bacteriology and be bacteriology majors, or physiological chemistry and be PChem majors, as graduate students, their support came from the molecular biology training program. Also, they were their professor was allocated money for supplies and equipment from this training program. And they could never, people from other places could never understand how it could work. And you know, it goes back to the question, if there were good microbial geneticists in genetics, maybe it was more important that the bacteriology department, in the position that it had, hire somebody in food microbiology, because that's where we needed some more work done.
How does that relate, though, to the remark that Hector DeLuca made on the biochemistry departments being unwilling in the, I suppose, the 50s to hire people who were in molecular biology, and he said as a result of their not doing that, they got way behind. And you know, is that something different from what you're saying?
Oh, I don't know if it's different. I guess it's an expression of discontent with what I've been saying, that some people felt that departments, well, Phil Coyne always felt that they should have people representing many facets of biochemistry, although some of those facets were represented in other departments on the campus, even though they may not have been biochemistry. They may have been over in the chemistry department, but he wanted a rounded department here in the medical school.
So this is two different ways of looking at
not only how to organize the faculty, but how to use the resources that you have available.
Well, would you be thought to be conservative then, I suppose?
I don't think I would be thought to be conservative. I would be thought to represent one point of view.
I see.
Now, which one is liberal and which one is conservative,
well,
I don't know.
Not in the sense of liberal.
Oh, I know that. No, I don't. I guess my feeling would be if it's advancing on the campus, and at least if you have in your department people who are working in those areas, they don't necessarily have to call themselves, say, microbial geneticists. And as long as Millard Sussman and the group in genetics taught a course that our undergraduates could take, we felt that we didn't have to hire anyone who could teach a course in microbial genetics. But as soon as Sussman's course became a very specialized, sort of very high graduate postdoc level course, then we saw the need for a course in microbial genetics to be taken by our advanced undergraduates and our beginning graduate students. And that's when we got Martha Howe to come here to teach it.
It's pertinent to the issue.
Why a department of dairy science and department of animal science? Well, I get this as an example of the kind of thing we're talking about. Back in the late 1930s, early 1940s, in order to bring a man in dairy work here, they created a department for him and made it for Ed Heiser. Now, I may be all wrong, but this is the way I understand it. Made a department of dairy husbandry, it was at that time, and that has grown into a department of, I guess, of national, international stature now as a dairy science department.
Well, what kind of animals are in animal husbandry then?
Everything else. Everything other than dairy cattle.
But isn't that why the molecular biology lab was formed, to keep Halverson here? That's what I,
oh, no.
And Friess.
I don't think so. The molecular biology was, yes, Harlan was pushing it at the time, and maybe it was formed to keep him here. I know it had a lot to do with, well, he was in bacteriology and he wanted to expand, and there just wasn't any way for him to expand his activities.
You mean spatially?
Spatially, yes, and among other things. And so the National Science Foundation had money available for building programs for new developments, and molecular biology was one of them.
Yeah.
And Harlan put together a proposal that went through the graduate school, and it was accepted by NSF. And biophysics was doing the same thing at the same time, and they put the two together, and then the Alumni Research Foundation gave them the additional money they needed to build the building. And sure, Harlan was the first director of it, and I'm sure it helped in keeping Harlan here for several years longer than he might otherwise.
Yes.
But it was put up as a research lab, and the other thing you've got to keep in mind that I'm not sure when the PhD program in molecular biology was put together. That is independent of the molecular biology laboratory, and so because it's the same. It's people in the molecular biology lab, but it's also people in other parts of the campus. And the molecular biology PhD program as a program degree is not. I'm not talking about the same thing as the molecular biology training program.
No. Yeah. Well, it presumably preceded. In fact, I think you mentioned it. Is this the sort of thing you meant when you said that Clodius had finally gotten it established that if you had six candidates who wanted a degree in a subject?
No. What I said was that there is such a thing as a committee PhD.
Yes.
And when it became hard to get new PhD programs approved, there were groups who were just forming committees and getting permission from the graduate school to give a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them would use the same requirements that had been approved by the graduate school for a committee degree for a number of students. And that was a way of getting around having to have a new PhD program approved.
Mm.
So finally,
this was by the coordinating committee.
Coordinating committee, that's right. And finally, the coordinating committee began to look at that, and so the question came up of how many people, or how many degrees can you give of the same kind of, a mix of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
How many can you give with a committee and not call it a degree program?
Yeah.
And Bob Clodius made the ruling that, well, if you give more than five or six, then you're going to have to get permission through getting the degree program established as a degree program.
You mean something more formal than just going through...
Just getting the graduate school to appoint a committee of faculty members to give a special PhD degree called a committee degree. that could be a mix of zoology, botany, bacteriology, and biochemistry, for example, and not meet the degree requirements of either of these, any of these departments, just meet the degree requirements set up by the committee and approved by the administrative committee of the graduate school. That's called a committed PhD. And that is still, that's still being done.
Yes.
Or it was the last I knew anything about it. So if you set up these requirements, then it became very easy to say, look, we already have a committee degree, and we'll just use those same requirements for John Jones, and then Steve Smith comes along, and he wants to use the same thing. And so before long, you're giving a number of degrees, a number of students degrees that were never approved by the higher authority on it. And that's when Bob Clodius ruled you. When you give more than five, that exceeds the limit, five or six. You got to get permission then and call it
from
a degree program.
From more than just the graduate school.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
you've got to go through, you got to go through the graduate school, the Madison campus, up now to the university academic people in the top of Van Nuys, and to the regents.
Yes.
As a new degree program.
Okay, that makes sense. You seem to link that to molecular biology, because I thought you said that, I could have misunderstood or written it down wrong, that there was a finally developed a degree program in molecular biology.
Yes.
And that preceded.
But that preceded the molecular biology building.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, not about the building, but the 66 was when molecular biology lab was set up.
Mm-hmm. And the molecular biology degree was, I'm pretty sure, as a degree program, was approved before that.
Yeah. Okay. We're still on the subject of research, really, in science. To what extent did the medical school, did you cooperate? I guess you didn't need to at all in the work you were doing. You were with veterinary science.
That's right.
The reason I'm asking this is that it's been complained that the medical school is not strong in research, and that this has been a source of weakness for the life sciences, that they haven't been able to lean on. And I just wonder what your experience is there.
Well, my experience was that, for the campus as a whole, the strong basic science department for research in the medical school was physiological chemistry. And that's because of Phil Cohen's getting a lot of people here and getting money to the need, what he considered the need for a good rounded physiological chemistry department. Phil was the kind that got out and built a department, is what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
Where some of the other faculty members in the basic science departments did not see the need like Phil did, and so did not seek expansion of the departments in which they were located. And in the camp, for the campus as a whole, there was always very active cooperation in the sciences with the physiological chemistry, and of course with oncology.
Yes.
There always was.
That would be the others.
But with MedMicro, we had, simply because a lot of us were interested in the same things, we attended seminars. Our students came over here and took the microbiology courses and so on. But there was not a whole lot of that interaction between bacteriology and MedMicro in terms of research programs. We had more interaction with biochemistry and even with physiological chemistry than we did with MedMicro. Now, there's another reason for that. MedMicro had much more interaction with veterinary science than they did with bacteriology. Both the people in veterinary science and in med micro were really interested in problems of infectious diseases, of the host-parasite relationship. In bacteriology, the emphasis was placed on the parasite itself, on the microorganism. And another way of saying that is, and just because a person is interested in bacteriology and does work in bacteriology, even in medical bacteriology, of working with the organisms in the laboratory, doesn't mean that person is an infectious disease person.
Yes.
It takes a person who knows as much about the host as they do about the parasite. And I think that's the real difference here, because we, Deward Walker, who's chairman of MedMicro, has said over the years that they had more interactions with vet science than they did with bacteriology for just that reason. In fact, is Deward at one time had a joint research program from NIH with the people in vet science, just like we had with, well, Dave Berman is a infectious disease, animal infectious disease person, but he's also a very good basic bacteriologist himself. So,
but I would gather that it wasn't a particularly strong department.
Well, a lot of people have said so. I would disagree with it. It was a small department. They did an awful lot of teaching, had a big teaching load of medical students and nursing students. Vic Seastone's research on the streptococci and on salmonella was just first-class research. But Vic was a very retiring person, and he didn't go out of his way to mix with other, even here in the medical school, he didn't. And, well, you've got to look at at the number of people they had here. Dr. Clark, who started this department, came here in 1914. And started the department, I believe, in the middle 30s, something like that. Was known as a good teacher, and he was an excellent teacher, a very stimulating lecturer, a kind of old-fashioned orator, if you wish. And he did work with Elvium, on nutrition in terms of animals or monkeys and susceptibility to poliovirus. Dr. Clark had a lot of students, but when you compare the number of graduate students here, and I'll compare them here in bacteriology, MedMicro, through the years, probably had 6 or 7 graduate students working here.
Hmm.
Bacteriology had 60.
Yeah.
There are people that I knew here when I was a graduate student, because I was, even though I was working on physiology over there, I was still interested in microorganisms of medical importance. Fred Rasmussen was here as a grad student. I got to know him very well. He's been at UCLA for a number of years and is associate dean of the medical school there. And I see Fred, well, Fred comes back here quite frequently. He married Bessie Tatum, and Mrs. Tatum still lives up on Summit Avenue, and Fred's here usually once a year. In fact, he was here last summer, and we had a delightful time with him. But Fred was one of Dr. Clark's PhDs, and then took an MD. Harold Ellingson, who took a PhD here, and then an MD, was chairman of preventive medicine at Ohio State for a number of years.
Well,
it's numbers, if you want to look at it that way.
Well, numbers and encouragement of the
numbers thing. And encouragement. This is right.
Bowers pushed hard to get more interest in research.
That's right.
But I hear, for instance, Henry Lardy was talking about a couple of people. You know about that?
Well, I don't know what.
Well, just that we're in medicine and research in some way and couldn't get enough space and couldn't get the kind of help they would have needed mm-hmm. cooperation to do research.
Yeah. Well, maybe that goes back to Dr. Middleton, who...
It definitely does, I believe.
Dr. Middleton was dedicated to training the family physician.
Yes.
You've heard that before.
Oh, yes.
And
there's no question of it.
And so he didn't push research. Mm-hmm. And I know that this didn't sit too well with Dr. Fred and other people. And Dr. Fred was in the graduate school and the president of the university. He felt that the medical school should be in the forefront of research just like the Ag College was.
Mm.
In terms of an applied type of thing. But I think the medical school in recent years certainly has, in clinical research, they've done a lot and are doing. I see where Dean Mosier, who is in jointly in medicine and P. Kim, but he is an MD, is cited as one of the outstanding young researchers of the world in his work on blood clotting factors, just recently cited for that. And certainly there's no, the Harold Rush and the people over in...
Oh, well, yes, I do think oncology is an exception.
Oncology is an exception, and P. Kim probably are the exceptions.
Except I don't know that it's had been up in the ratings very much. Bacteriology and biochemistry.
Yeah.
We're almost at the end of this tape, and I expect it's time to. So I would like to ask you what was meant by, I think it was Bob Burris' statement, that you had to rescue the medical microbiology department.
Well, I wouldn't put it like that. No, it wasn't. I don't think so. It was this. George Walker, Vic Seastone was chairman of the department, and admittedly, Vic was a very low-key. Vic tended to his own knitting and his own research, so to speak, and he didn't push for the department. Okay. Well, when he had his health problem and had to give up the chairmanship, and as a matter of fact, he semi-retired. I don't know whether you ever knew Vic Seastone or not, but very charming man. His hobby was ceramics, and he spent a lot of time on it. And Vic did a lot of research. Well, so this department was in a sad way in terms of physical facilities and in terms of people. And when Peter Eichen was dean of the medical school, he got me to get some bacteriologists from other parts of the country to come here and give him a report that he could use to help them, which we did. That was in 1968 or 69, somewhere in that, whenever Pete was dean of the medical school. And Deward has said that report helped them a lot in getting more money and helped Peter in providing more money. And as you well know, that's how these things are done. You get a report that downgrades the department, from some pretty respectable people, and you begin to think we've got to put some money into it. Well, so this helped Deward. And then Peter also, when Vic got sick, Peter also appointed a committee to look for a new chairman, and he wanted one, and I was on the committee, and he wanted the committee to bring somebody from outside. We told him that we just couldn't do it because the physical facilities here, but you couldn't expect someone to come in from outside to take over this department, and the best thing we could see was to appoint George Walker as chairman, if Deward would take it. And so we helped talk Deward into taking it. And then So that finally comes to the question you asked. Deward said he would take it until they got new facilities and they were to get the whole fourth floor of SMI, I mean whole fourth floor of this complex, which MedMicro now has. Mm-hmm. They had just a little section of SMI before that. Okay. And in the late 1960s, that was fairly imminent. But the thing drug on, and in 1976, Deward Walker said, I've had enough. Can't we get another chairman? And had the same problem then as they did 6 years before. There just wasn't any physical facility here to bring anybody of quality you would want into it. So the committee that I wasn't on at that time, looking for a new chairman, asked me to come over and talk to him, and from that led to the idea that since I was no longer chairman over at Bacteriology in 1976 and was getting ready to retire then, mm-hmm. The dean asked if I would come over and be chairman and help with this new construction, which I did. So I wouldn't call it rescuing. I wouldn't say that. I would say I came over and did a job for them that they asked me to do to help them so that we, in planning of all these new facilities, and the dean of the medical school at that time had agreed that MedMicro needed three new people. They could hire three or four new people. When we got the physical facilities finished over here, and we thought we had in 1979, 1980 maybe it was, we thought we had hired an outstanding man to come here and be chairman. And I thought it for 6 months, and that's when I retired. And we thought he was going to come, but he went to Johns Hopkins and instead to head up their microbiology group in the School of Public Health. So,
because they offered him more money, or did he
no,
not?
No, he was East Coast, and he wanted to stay on the East Coast. He had family on the East Coast, and he wanted to stay there. That was what he told us. Now, what the reasons were, probably a combination of a lot of things.
Did you get three new people?
There are three new people now who've been hired that are just top-notch people. One of them is P.